So this mother comes in and her son is sleeping. The mother says, "Get up, get up. It's time for school. You have to get to school." Says, "I don't want to go to school." She says, "Get up, get up. You have to go to school." He says, "I don't want to. There are two reasons I don't want to go to school. All the children hate me, and all the teachers, they hate me too." She says, "Get up, get up. You still have to go to school. There are two reasons you have to go to school. You're 51 years old, and you're the principal."
Okay, I've got to do one too then. But this is just for technical balance.
Yeah, this is just the sound check.
Yeah. So this young boy was telling his friend, "I want to die peacefully in my sleep like my grandfather, not like the people in the back seat who are screaming in terror of the car he was driving."
We're going to talk about bringing our spirituality into daily life and how to achieve both balance in our life while we're still achieving inner depth. And many years ago, some of you probably heard that Swamiji told the people at Ananda that we should seek in this life to become Jivan Muktas. That means Jivan Mukta is a term loosely translated, free while living. And it means basically that you have transcended the ego, but you may still have some past karma that you have to overcome. And so that goal of transcending the ego should be, for all of us, the goal. And I think for the vast majority of people who are at Ananda, that would be the goal. And I'm not sure that I had that goal early on. I think it was St. Paul who prayed, "Make me a saint, but not yet."
Augustine.
Pardon?
Augustine.
Thank you. I stand corrected. At any rate, if we don't want to be a Jivan Mukta, I'm sure everybody in the room at least wants to be a Jivan Mukta. And so I want to talk today from the standpoint of talking from that viewpoint, and so that in our discussion, in our sharing today and this afternoon, that we take it from a standpoint of taking it deep as opposed to just broad. So that desire to be a Jivan Mukta doesn't surface for a very, very long time in the incarnational cycle, one might say. In fact, as Master said to one of his disciples, even to want to know God, it takes very, 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 very good karma, even to want to know God. And so that comes before the desire to completely dissolve the ego. So assuming that we're all, if not, at some point, I don't want to point up, at some point we're on that slippery slope down into the dissolution of the ego. All the ego is, it isn't something separate. See, the soul, which is the only thing that we really are, all we really are, is God. But God has a drama going on where, for whatever his, her reasons, from time to time, he causes outer manifestation to take place. The way Lahiri Mahashaya talked about it was that God, he used the term still prana, that prana is energy and intelligence combined. And so that intense energy intelligence In the completely still state is God's natural state. The Adi Shankaracharya said that in that state, there is existence, there is eternal knowing, you know, of consciousness and bliss, Satchitananda. So existence, consciousness, and bliss. So that's the state of that still consciousness. And what Lahiri said is from time to time, during the outward, the day of Brahma, as it's called, when there's an outer manifestation, that a small part of that consciousness becomes dynamic prana as opposed to still prana. And we can think of the dynamic prana as being the vibration of light or the vibration of sound. Vibration of the universe is talked about as being translated into the sound of Om. But at any rate, that dynamic prana in vibration produces, between those two poles, produces duality. And that duality, Master used to use the image of a picture on a screen. And so if you go to a movie, and Master would do this, and Swami did it to us one time, but Master would wait until there was a real intense part of the movie, and then he'd tap the people sitting near to him on the shoulder, and he'd say, "See, look up. See, it's all a beam of light and dark, and that's what's producing the drama." And we get absolutely engrossed in it. I don't know if any of you saw the movie Chariots of Fire. Probably some of you did. At any rate, it's about these two people. One, in fact, truly was a saint, Eric Little, the Christian who refused to run. We just saw a documentary on him. He was a really high soul. At any rate, these two British runners were in the Olympics, and they had been training and training and training, and so finally the race comes, and there's all this beautiful music by Vangelis, and they're running, and it's all in slow motion, and you can see them straining and straining, and the whole movie is built up to this, and Swami taps us on the shoulder, kind of points, he says, "It's not easy to be unattached at a moment like that." But he was saying, and Master was saying, see, that everything that seems to be here, of course, to our senses and to our mind, seems very real, very solid, very much is here. And on a certain level, it is. But it's that play of light and dark that is producing that. Or we can also use the analogy of a dream. You know, as we dream at night, that dream within the dream seems very real. It's only because we wake up in the morning that we can then look back and say, "Oh, well, I was dreaming. That was really weird. You know, I was skiing uphill. I don't know how I could ski uphill, you know," or whatever the dream is. But within the dream, at the time we're dreaming, that dream seems very real. So we're caught in a cosmic dream right now. What does it mean we're caught? The soul is caught in the state of dynamic prana. But we're still only God. We're only that consciousness of God, but God's in that, and Lahiri said God takes only 1% of his consciousness. The other 99 stays in the still state, but that 1% becomes dynamic, and that produces the whole of creation. And so we're a little part of that dynamic, vibrating consciousness of God. And so within that drama, within the dynamic aspect, each of us is like a spark of God. And we come with the same qualities of that still prana. At our essence, we're nothing more than Satchitananda. but we're playing this drama. Last night we talked about the fact that Master's first book, he talked about how every soul is motivated. Once we come into manifestation, from that point on, you are constantly going to be wanting something. You will never be satisfied. You will never be at that still state because you aren't in that still state. And so the soul is yearning to get back to that still state. But in the dynamic state of prana, and especially at the lower levels of this evolutionary process, we don't cognize that what we want is to get back into Satchitananda. And in fact, Swami used this beautiful image in the book about education of specific gravity. According to our specific gravity, according to how light we are, according to how much uplifted consciousness there is, the farther down that vibrational, one could say, scale, the more, less still it is. And in fact, Lahiri said that the different chakras vibrate at a different rate. The reason that we meditate here is because it vibrates at a very slow rate. He even gave numbers to it. This vibrates from 0 to 10, from 0 to 10. This vibrates at the rate of 100, and this at 1,000, and this at 10,000, and so on. So by the time we're at the base of the spine, the subtle spine at the lowest chakra, that vibration is very fast, and it's not a still state. And so meditation teaches us to withdraw, because as it vibrates very fast, that energy goes out. And until we withdraw the consciousness from that outward flowing energy, we are not going to be able to meditate very deeply or maintain the stillness of meditation. But as that prana comes in and comes up, and as we concentrate here, produce magnetic consciousness there, that consciousness rises, and our minds and our emotions and our vibrational level gets stiller and stiller. But it won't do any good to be upset at yourself for having restless meditations if you don't withdraw the energy. I use the analogy, imagine a pillow, a feather pillow, and you open it up and you dump all those feathers on a table. And you say, now, feathers, stay in place. Don't move around. They're all restless thoughts, potentially restless thoughts. Don't move around. I want you to stay still. And then you turn on the fan and it's spinning around at 100,000 revolutions a minute. And you're saying, wow, you are terrible feathers. You're going all over. I'm so guilty. I'm so... What do? You turn down the rheostat so that fan gets slower and slower and slower, and then those feathers don't go all over the place. So the technique of Hong Sa, the technique, that's why we worked on the energization this morning before meditation. The technique of energization, learning to control the flow of that prana, is learning how to turn the rheostat of restlessness down. And so as restlessness begins to decrease, why does restlessness decrease? Because the energy rises in the spine, so it's just a mathematical process in one sense. Of course, it's all consciousness. But we have control over our will, if not complete control. We have choices all the time. And those choices are basically, do we want that energy to rise or do we want it to drop? Do we want to be more still, or do we want to be more restless? Do we want to be more unattached, or do we want to go around and get to the malls and do a lot of shopping? I grew up in Minnesota. Apparently, there's a huge mall there, mega mall there. And I had a niece who set up tours of Japanese tourists who flew over for a long weekend only to shop at the mega mall, the biggest mall in the world at the time, you know. So if you're restless, that kind of thing is attractive to you. And why are you restless? Because your energy is descending, and it's primarily in those lower chakras. And so if that's the state, those feathers are going all over the place. And most people think, wow, it's wonderful. Look how they're flying. Look how they're going. They're all over the place. Isn't this fun? Aren't we having fun? But gradually, Master said, that takes on an anguishing sense of monotony. You just get tired of that. You get tired of the restlessness. And then you come to the point, if you don't want to be a Jivan Mukta, at least you want to be a Jivan Mukta. You want to get back to that still state. And so as the kind of specific gravity comes up more, you automatically, your consciousness changes, and a whole bunch of beautiful things happen. As that consciousness rises up, as it comes, think of specific gravity now. So here we are in the lower chakras, and mainly what we want, especially if the energy is descending, as it descends, it also contracts. And so then we think primarily of ourselves. And if we're at the mega mall, we'll be elbowing people out of the way trying to get to the sales. You know, I mean, I've heard of people fighting and even killing other people to try to get the bargains. I mean, it's absurd, but that's what happens with the descending energy. As it ascends, the opposite happens. As it comes up, and as the specific gravity is higher in the heart, you just feel kindliness and love and compassion for everybody you see. And Swamiji was such a beautiful example of that risen energy. And in the heart, especially in his later years, he was just kind of pure love and pure joy. And just to be around him, there was a beautiful story. Some of you have heard of it, where Swamiji was in Gurgaon. He had flown there from, Gurgaon's in India. He'd flown to the place where his house from Italy. And in the later years, this was a year or two before his passing, those trips were very hard on his body. And so somebody there suggested that there's a young man who is a very good masseuse, and he's been coming to the house, and some people have been getting a massage from him. Would you like to have a massage? Swami said, yes, I think that could be helpful. And so this young man came, and he asked Swami to lay on the bed, and he gave him a massage while Swami was laying on the bed. But of course, the young man was all bent over doing that. And Swami said, wouldn't it be better if you had a massage table? That would be easier for you. And the young man said, oh, it would be better, sir, but they're very expensive. This is the first time Swami ever met that man. He said, well, I would like to buy you one. And the young man said, oh, sir, they're very expensive. Swami said, go find out. Do you have any idea what the price would be? And I think the young man said, I think they may be 10,000 rupees, which is like $150, maybe 200 at the time. And Swami said, well, go out and find one, and I'll buy it for you. Well, the next day, Swami had another massage. The young man came back, and he said, oh, sir, I went and checked on the price, and they're much more expensive. They're double that cost. Swami said, still, I would like to buy you one. Go ahead and get one and have the bill sent to me. And then as this young man was leaving, he said, you know, at first I can't buy one. I have a family. This is a second job being a masseuse. I have to have two jobs just in order to be able to feed my family. At any rate, so it was difficult circumstances. As he was leaving, he said to one of the people there, he was weeping. He said, when I grew up, I was an orphan. I was abandoned on the streets. And I had to fend for myself. And so I gradually just learned how to work, learned how to find things. But the biggest thing that I was always missing was the feeling of being loved, and especially the love of a father. And today I've found that. Now, I don't think Swami consciously knew the story, but that energy had risen into his heart, and he couldn't help himself. In a way, he couldn't help himself from feeling love and kindness and compassion and unity with everyone. So it isn't mental. It has to do with our specific gravity. In the Gita, that's why they say, what are the qualities of a saint? Cares nothing for whether he's rich or poor. Kindness flows to him for friends, for enemies, like, and so on and so forth. The specific gravity expresses itself in a certain way. Okay, so for us now, the job that we have is to work on those things that will change our specific gravity, will help it to rise, and to, once we change, to try to keep it in a more uplifted state. Now, all of us go up and down. Specific gravity, you know, is usually used how high something will float in a body of water. Well, we're in a turbulent sea, and so even though we may have a specific gravity, nonetheless, the waves are pushing us up and down, even within that specific gravity. So you all know, some days you're tired, some days you're grumpy, some days a masseuse comes over and you just as soon tell him his business, not because you have any right to tell him his business, just because you're grumpy. And so we go up and down a little bit. But we do have a choice all the time, not so much specifically, although we even have that, but at least we have the choice of trying to move our energy in an upward direction from wherever we are, wherever our specific gravity is. Master used the beautiful image of the spiral stairway of wakefulness. So think of a long, long spiral stairway. Specific gravity is we're somewhere up and down. And we can't be two-thirds of the way up or three-quarters of the way up, still have 1,000 steps and say, I think I'll just jump up 1,000 steps. We have to move up, but we do have the choice, wherever we are, of taking the next step in an upward direction or taking the next step in a downward direction. And that's within our ability. And so when we have those choices, we need to try to train ourselves to move in an upward direction. So when we're with other people, we need to try to train ourselves to think of them as brothers, as sisters, as friends, everybody, not just those who you feel close to, but everybody. And as we do that, the specific gravity begins to rise. At first, it's affirmation. But gradually, that affirmation turns into reality. And you do, in fact, feel a kindness and a sense of connectedness with everyone. And it may or may not express outwardly. Some saints don't express much outwardly at all. Others do a great deal. It may not express outwardly, but it will express in some way. There's a beautiful story of a saint who prayed, very high saint who prayed, that, Lord, wherever my shadow touches someone, let that person be healed, but let me never know. Beautiful prayer. And so there are, we may not know our effect on other people because it's a universal prayer. But okay, so how do we achieve, first of all, depth in our life? Well, when we were in India a few years ago, we were with Swamiji, and we got talking about this paradigm of being a Jivanmukta. And we weren't exactly whining, but we were saying, gosh, that's a tough goal. I don't know, you know, whether we're making much progress or whether we're going to achieve it. I'll take a little aside here. Davy just gave me the nod of approval. So one time Davy and I were talking, and she said, I don't know that I'm going to be able to be a Jivanmukta in this life. And I said to her, well, why don't you assume that you're going to make it and then have a plan B? Which I think is good general advice. So assume that you're going to become a Jivanmukta, but then have a plan B. And then some time later, a couple of years later, we were in Seattle giving Sunday service in Seattle, and Davy spoke first. And during her part of the talk, she mentioned just what I'd said, you know, assume that you're going to make it and then have a plan B. And then it was my turn because we were both speaking, as we will tomorrow and today too. So we're both speaking. So I came up and I said, I'm not sure that all of you know who I am. I'm Plan B. And so we should be seeking that goal. So we were with Swamiji and a little bit whining about, this is a hard goal, Swami. And Swami was eating breakfast, and he picked up his fork, he paused halfway to his mouth, and he said, the whole of the spiritual path is to overcome the delusion of the ego. And that is done by longer, deeper meditations and by seeing God as the doer in everything. And then put the food in his mouth and started chewing. That was it. That was the summation of the whole spiritual path in 5 seconds or 10 seconds. So let's look at that. First of all, longer, deeper meditations. So the first step toward longer, deeper meditations is to meditate. You don't get longer, deeper ones until you get one that's a minute long and as shallow as anything. And so the first step is to become regular in our meditations. And so we have here, you all have a beautiful environment for that because you have other people who will support you in that. It's very helpful. It's said that the most important influence on the spiritual path is the blessing and grace of the guru. The second most important is true satsang, the gathering of others who have that same goal of, here we're defining it as moksha or being a jivan mukta. And so having others who will support that and who will join their energies together, and the group magnetism helps every individual. And so having that, but it's up to you individually to establish your practice of meditation on a daily basis. So that's the first challenge, is being regular, because the world outside of us is not built in order to help us become deep meditators. The world outside of us is built to spread those feathers around as much as possible. And all those advertisers out there, believe me, they are not trying to turn down the rheostat to make things calm and unattached. They want you restless, and they want you, the media wants you upset, they want you in a state of emotional disturbance, because in that state you keep checking Google every 5 minutes to see if Trump said something else today, or Hillary did some other outrageous thing, or what happened in the, I've just got to know, it could be another attack in the Mideast. You know, the desire of them is to keep you restless and to keep you addicted to trying to find out whether they have the latest information to continue that. So the world outside of us is at best neutral and generally speaking inimical to our inner peace, to our desire to be a jivan mukta. So along with trying to meditate, one of the things we need to do is gradually detach ourselves from how much interaction we have. That again, the spiral staircase, you have a choice. When you get up in the morning, you have a choice of whether to meditate or whether to go to your iPhone or computer and turn it on and get plugged in, or turn the television on in the kitchen and then the one in the living room and the one back in the bedroom and the radio in the bathroom, lest you lose any of the information from talk radio. So you have the choice. One rises the energy up and you become still and less attached and more directed toward being a jivan mukta. Your specific gravity rises. You become loving, you become calm, you become giving and caring about people, and the other pulls your energy down, and you see, as we say every Sunday service, you're like the little bird that says, what else is wisdom if not to keep what is mine for myself? What if Swami said to that young man, what else is wisdom? You want a $200 massage table? What else is wisdom except for me to keep that money for myself? A lot of people would, or at least think that way, but they wouldn't be Swami if they did. They wouldn't be at that jivan mukta stage. And so we have that choice up or down. So now we're talking about meditation. First, we have to establish the daily practice of meditation, and best to get it solid, at least at the beginning and the end of each day. Master said that we need to start the day with meditation and with energization, as we have learned. It's just a habit practice, habit pattern, and meditation. And then at the end of the day, we need to end our day by having a meditation before we go to sleep. And if we do that, and then he said, if you meditate at the beginning of the day and the end of the day, and you work during the day with concentration, but doing it for God, then you'll keep in balance. And so having those two points, I'm going to give a little visual demonstration here. Oh, there it is, my prop. So as a child, you probably did this, where you balance something. So you balance like that. Okay, now what's happening when I balance that?
Ananda's got talent.
Ananda's, yeah. I'm not sure whether I'm going to make it all the way to American Idol or whatever that show is called with that. But without cognizing, because what I'm doing there, when I balance, I'm getting the axis of this, the top point and the bottom point, aligned with the center of gravity at the center of the Earth. And so that axis is aligned with the core of the Earth. Well, if you get your axis aligned with your core values, then it's going to be in balance. And if you don't, it's going to be out of balance, and it's going to tip one way or another. And so what we need to do is align the top and the bottom with the core of our values. We're saying, for the sake of discussion, that core value is being a Jivan Mukta. Let's call now this being morning and this being evening. And if we align those two points with the core value of being a Jivan Mukta, then the rest, this being the rest of the day, will take care of itself. And we have to try to keep it in balance. It's not going to stay there. But I did this demonstration up in Seattle, and someone came and gave me a very, very interesting and pertinent advanced technique of staying in balance. She said that when she was younger, she had a job in some sort of a metal factory, and they would magnetize pieces of metal, putting them under a big electromagnet. She said they would take a bolt like that, and they would set it in there and turn on the magnet, and boom, it would align itself. So that electromagnet is master, or it's God. That flow of energy is the grace, and that will align you. That's why Master said the most important thing for the devotee is attunement with the guru, because that gets us in alignment with that magnetic flow, and we then stay in balance. Master said the highest prayer is, I will reason, I will, I will act. But guide thou my thought, reason, and activity, my reason, will, and activity to the right path in everything. And so that attunement will keep us in a state of balance. But in practice, what that means is that attunement comes by, I will reason, but guide thou my reason. So if you're trying to make a decision about something, if you remember, ask Master, I'll reason, I'll think this through, I'll try to figure out how to create the courtyard out here, but Master, guide my reasoning, guide my activity so that it's in tune with what you want. Guide me in how to make this beautiful, how to make it sattvic, how to make it a space where people will feel uplifted. And if we consciously keep doing that, guide my reason. Help me figure this out, Master. Just Davy and I get emails from all over the world, and very often I don't know what to do or what to say, but I have trained myself to ask Master to guide me in what to say. And generally it works. Well, I'm not sure whether it works out or not, but I'll guarantee you it works out a whole lot better than if I say, Master, I don't want you to guide me. I'm going to do this on my own, and I'm really going to tell that person what they're needing to hear, and I'm going to give them a good tongue lashing. That doesn't work out so well, especially on emails. So at any rate, this staying in attunement during the day, keeping the top and the bottom. So coming back to meditation, train yourself to meditate in the morning and in the evening. And if you do that, you'll at least have meditation. Once you have that established, they can become longer and they can become deeper. They will automatically become deeper as they get longer, but you also have to work on trying to still your mind as much as you can. That's why we have the whole spiritual path, the techniques that we have. Remember, we're trying to keep those feathers from flying all over the place. Kriya is specifically designed for that, to still the restless thoughts, as is Hong Sa. So Kriya works on the rheostat, on the fan that is making those things fly around. And so the use of the techniques that we have of various ways of controlling prana, along with that is devotion. That brings us in balance. See, devotion is really the energy of the heart is pivotal. And the heart's energy, which is feeling or desire, that energy, think of this as midpoint on the spiral staircase. And if from this point we have desires that push the energy down and out, that means we're descending in consciousness that spiral staircase. But the energy that draws up and in means we're ascending that spiral staircase. And so from this pivotal point, which is what we desire, we have a choice at that pivoting point. And if we take that choice and we say, I'm going to use my heart's energy, my heart's desire, in order to love Master, in order to love God. And how am I going to do that? I'm going to chant. I'm going to chant these beautiful chants that he gave us. I'm going to read his writings. I'm going to listen to his voice. I'm going to look at his picture. I'm going to try to concentrate and visualize him at the spiritual eye. The spiritual eye is also the seat of the guru. And so I'm going to try to put Master here, and that will automatically draw my heart's energy so that it doesn't descend and go out and be restless. It will draw my heart's energy upward. And in meditation, that's why in the stiller state, when we're less restless, when we're less distracted, when we've got ourselves more under control and we can control that, we should practice the deepest possible devotion, the deepest possible self-offering. Toward the end of your meditations, especially, the beginning of the meditation are devoted to doing the techniques as well as you can with as deep of a concentration as you can. Toward the end of meditation should be the time. Remember this morning when we did the energization? Tense with will. Do your techniques with will. Relax and feel. And so that last part of your meditation should be relax and feel. After Kriya Yoga, you should relax and feel or look at light in the forehead and try to feel that your energy, your whole self-definition is rising up and going into that light and dissolving. Swami defined the ego one time as a bundle of self-definitions. And think all those, that bundle of self-definitions are like little icicles. And they're going up, they're floating up in your relaxed concentration into that light at the spiritual eye. And they're just melting, they're just dissolving. And so we're trying to dissolve the ego, but the intensity of that is a choice that we make. We can't make it very easily until we get our energy at least a little bit interiorized. But once we do, then try always to end your toward the last part of your meditation, to have that be just a total, complete, loving self-offering and desire to be received by Master or received by Divine Mother or whatever form of God awakens that uplifted heart energy for you. And the longer and deeper we can stay in that state, that's the real life-transforming grace of meditation. Master said that looking into the light will actually change our brain cells. It will change our heart cells. It'll change the direction of our vibration. So doing that, so trying to achieve first regular, then longer and deeper meditations, because in meditation, the mind gets restless and then it gets still, restless and still, but it's like this, it gets stiller and stiller in a kind of wave-like motion. So a longer meditation, 3 hours this morning, I'm sure those of you who participated felt that you probably were deeper toward the end of the meditation and deeper than you usually are in meditation because you've got time for that rhythm to take place. So longer, deeper meditations. And then as we work, feel, first of all, that we're aligning ourselves with Master, that's, or with God, giving our will, aligning our will with God's will. And then beyond that lies, it isn't our will. We're only a spark of God. There's only one dreamer. We, as the character of the dream, are not the real actor in this. God is the only actor. So as Swami said, to act by seeing that God is doing everything. Longer, deeper meditation and seeing God as the doer in everything that you do. That's the way to both stay in balance, to go deep. And when we do that, our life transforms and our actions transform, our consciousness transforms, our desires, everything changes. And we, if we don't arrive at the final goal of this life of being a Jivan Mukta, at least we have enormous momentum toward it. And Krishna promises in the Gita that no effort is ever lost, that if we don't make it in this lifetime, we will reincarnate in the next lifetime with that ongoing momentum. All of you have that ongoing momentum. Otherwise, you'd be out at the mall and wanting to have nothing to do with a discourse like this, not the way you want to spend a nice Saturday morning. But if we do, then our effort plus the effort of Master on our behalf and the effort of God, the grace of God, will carry us to the goal.
Master told all of his disciples to memorize his remarkable poem, Samadhi, which is there in Autobiography of a Yogi in the chapter, An Experience in Cosmic Consciousness. And I was so enjoying sitting here listening to Jyotish and looking at the quotes from Samadhi up on the upper level of your sanctuary. But I took his advice to heart, and many years ago I memorized it, and it's been a part of my life, a very meaningful part of my life for many years. But the more you inwardly repeat it in meditation, the more you see it simplifies. At first it seems like it's so many different concepts, but it simplifies, and you see there are actually just a few major themes. One is the dual nature of this world, light and shadow, and the ephemeral nature, the transitory and permanent nature of that duality. And then in contrast, the eternal cosmic reality behind that. And then finally, the joy that comes when we move out of the dualistic changing nature of this world. So the first, the beginning verses are, banish the veils of light and shade, lifted transitory, lifted every veil of sorrow, sailed away all dawns of fleeting joy. This is all passing. Gone the dim sensory mirage, duality again, love, hate, health, disease, life, death. Vanish these false shadows from the screen of duality. Again, it's all fading. Waves of laughter, scissors of sarcasm, melancholic whirlpools melting in the vast sea of bliss. All the transitory, it melts in the sea of bliss. And then you have the quote up there, the storm of Maya stilled by magic wand of intuition deep. And then he goes on to describe, we could spend the whole morning talking about that poem, but we won't. Another time maybe. But then he goes on and planets and stars and stardust. And then he finally, after going so far, just as Master in the chapter of Autobiography of a Yogi, when he has this experience of cosmic consciousness and his being goes out to the farthest boundaries of infinity. And then he says, I realize that the center of all creation was a point of intuitive perception in the human heart. That's the end of it all. Point of intuitive perception in the human heart. And then, from joy I came, for joy I live, in sacred joy I melt. And then at the end, Master's line of samadhi. How does it end? After going out into the cosmos, a tiny bubble of laughter, I have become the sea of mirth itself. And what does Sri Yukteswar do at the end of that experience for Master, from which came the poem Samadhi? He hands him a broom. Come, let's sweep the porch. And so spirituality in daily life, come, let's sweep the porch. But with this understanding, otherwise, it's all frustrating and illusory and disappointing and unfulfilling and leads us nowhere. But if we take these themes, the dual nature, the ephemerality of this duality, it won't last. It can't last. The good, the bad, the beautiful, the ugly, it can't last because it's not real. And beneath it all, there is a reality that is unchanging. And we are a part of that. And that unchanging quality, as we were saying, Satchitananda, ever conscious, ever existent, ever new joy. And that's what Master brought to us. Nothing more, nothing less. You live your daily life. I'm not telling you to go withdraw to the Himalayas. I'm not telling you to go and live in a monastery. I'm telling you to live your daily life, but with the joy of spirit, with the understanding that what seems so real is not real. And in our line of gurus, it's not by accident. Babaji's successor, one might say, in the line of gurus was Lahiri Mahashaya, who worked as an accountant in the British government for 40 years, I believe. He was, and he had many children. He had five children, three daughters, two sons. He was a simple householder. He went to his job every day. Babaji called him up to the Himalayas. Some of you have been to Babaji's cave. We had the good fortune, good karma to go there a number of times and meditate. But then Lahiri says, please let me stay here with you to Babaji in this remote district of Raniket in the Himalayas and spend my days enwrapped in samadhi meditation. And of course we know, what does Babaji say to him? No, you go back. Go back and be an accountant. Go back and be a doctor. Go back and work in the IT industry. Go back and whatever it is we do, be a housewife, take care of your children, be an acupuncturist. Go back and do it. But through your doing it, demonstrate how it's done with deeper wisdom, with deeper understanding. And, you know, it says in the autobiography, the Hiri's boss called him Ecstatic Babu. There he was, just adding the numbers, Ecstatic Babu, healing his the British engineer's wife in England, and her coming over and saying, when she sees the Hiri, that's the one I saw, appeared to me in light, healed me in my bed in England. And so this is the magic of what our masters brought us and why it's so important for these times. Because when you say spirituality in daily life, that kind of sounds like you're holding your breath to me, like, oh, I'm going to be really, really good and I'm just going to be spiritual. And you see a lot of new people on the path. And I'm not belittling anyone, but you just, you know, they come to Ananda Village or here, perhaps, and they're trying to be real spiritual and very pious and very humble. And Swami was so not that way. The very first day I ever met him, I arrived at Ananda Village, 4th of July, 1969, Ananda's birthday, as we were saying the other day. And I didn't know anybody. I didn't know what to expect, but Master just, people often ask me, why did you come? And I can make up lots of different answers, but the real answer is I have no idea. Master just took me like a little stray puppy by the scruff of my neck, took me from Wisconsin, plopped me down 4th of July, 1969 at Ananda Village and said, okay, this is your life now. You're not going to figure it out on your own, so I better just have emergency measures here. And so I was standing there totally befuddled, and this man walks past me. And he had kind of a Hawaiian print shirt on and Bermuda shorts. But there was like, there was a wake of energy behind him. I didn't know who he was. And I watched him, and I just thought, that's an interesting person. And he walked, we had a little common kitchen and dining area, and he said, oh, what's for dinner? Hash brown potatoes. I love hash brown potatoes. And then someone said, that's Swami Kriyananda. And then he came up to me, and to my shame, I was a accomplished student, one might say. And so I was a Phi Beta Kappa. And so the first thing he said to me, he looked at me, and I'd been traveling across the country for 4 days, like he did. Just I had cut off blue jeans on, an old shirt, a backpack, and, I hadn't had a shower for a while. And he just looked at me, and he said, you look like a Phi Beta Kappa. And that impressed me because I did not look like a Phi Beta Kappa. I looked like a little hippie that washed up on the shore. But anyway, that joy in daily life, he demonstrated in every aspect of what he did. But if we want to look then, well, how do we do that? How do we begin bringing the joy of spirit of longer, deeper meditations? And again, that's one of, let's see, I don't know if it's up here, but by deeper, longer, thirsty, guru-given meditation. Where does it come from, the power to have deeper meditations? Not by our own efforts, believe me. It's you can try and try and try with your own will, with your own sincerity, but then there's that moment where God says, okay, she's serious, he's serious, let's move her along here. So how do we bring that into our daily life, that joy of that we experience in deeper, longer, guru-given meditation? Well, let's, as an experiment, as an exercise, I should say, let's apply these three aspects of the poem Samadhi to different aspects of our daily life. So let's talk about relationships. People, parents, children, partners, coworkers, colleagues, person behind you in traffic, whatever it might be. So let's look at what's dual, what's based on duality, what's just light and shadow, and what's ephemeral, and what's real, and what's lasting and what's consistent and what can we depend on. You know, some years ago, Swami, Master told people not to pick up hitchhikers, but Swami was driving to give a class. This was not too long after he was thrown out of Self-Realization Fellowship, and he had very little. He was trying to rebuild his life. He had very little money. He had really not much of a support team, and he didn't have any support team, let's put it that way. And he was driving along, and he saw this man who really looked down and out, and his heart was touched by compassion, and so he picked the man up and to give him a ride. And the man started giving him a sob story. My wife is sick. My children, she can't care for the children. I've lost my job. And Swami got out his wallet and gave the man half of what he had. And the man said, let me give you my name and address and contact and all that, because I'll be sure to pay you back when I get a job, because I don't want you to lose your faith in human nature. And Swami's answer was great and wise. He said, if I had faith in human nature, I would have lost it long ago. I don't give this money to you because I have faith in human nature. I give this money to you because I have faith in God. Faith in God. And that's, I know God will see that I get the money back. And it did come back, not from that man. Swami never heard from him again. But it came back manyfold through other sources. So in our human relationships, we need to understand that we're all fallible. If we expect anybody in our life to always be perfect, to always make us happy, to always act in the way that we expect them, according to our own highest vision of what people should be like, veils of light and shade, it'll be blown away, and we'll live in constant disappointment, which inevitably leads to bitterness. And that's no good. That won't take us anywhere. But if we can say, well, what is real? What is lasting in my relationships with my partner, with my children? If they're going to disappoint me, if they're going to be changing, you look beyond that form and you see the higher aspect there. Once at Ananda Village, there was before the expanding light existed, we operated our guest facilities out of the meditation retreat. And there was a man who was the manager of the meditation retreat. And we were just coming up upon the biggest guest week of the year, Spiritual Renewal Week, which is coming up in August. I'll do a little advertisement there if you'd like to join us in our wonderful new facilities. So this fellow was a moody guy and lots of light and shade, and he quit. He just said, oh, this is too much. It's too many frustrations. It's not going the way I want. I'm walking out. Like 4 days before the big week, and there was nobody else in charge. So we scurried around and we pulled it together, and we told Swami, you know, we're really upset with this fellow. He left everybody in the lurch. Nobody wants to work with him anymore. So what did Swami say? Did he say, that was very bad? Look at, that's not how a devotee would ask. You know what he said? And it was one of the greatest, beautiful acts that I've ever seen. He said, gosh, if no one will work with him, then I guess I'll have to work with him. I'll hire him on my staff. And that fellow and became one of the best salespeople for Crystal Clarity, going all over the country selling Swami's books. Because Swami didn't tune into that which was ephemeral. Okay, the guy's moody. Okay, he made a bad call. He has light in him. And that's what I will affirm. So often people, particularly if you're a parent, if you have children, children are very tricky equations, you know. I mean, I think I learned more from being a parent than any other activity in the world, because you learn absolutely to see the eternal light, not the passing shadow that's happening in that moment. And I remember my brother was a very, had a very checkered career, let's put it that way. And but my mother was a lovely woman, and she always saw the best in him. And finally, he got his feet firmly going in a positive direction. And I feel it was in large part because my mother always accepted him, never rejected him, never criticized, never even got upset. She just was there to love him. And so to find the joy in our relationships, to find what's eternal and lasting, we have to approach it with that kind of the joy and love of God. Is that easy? Oh my goodness, no, it's not easy. It's the hardest thing we can do, but it's the only thing that's going to make us find fulfillment in our relationships. And if my brother is watching this, all my love, but also I have to say, one of the great joys in my life was he's getting on our path now. We went to visit him. He lives in Oceanside. And he said, oh, let's go to Encinitas. I like to go there and walk around. And so he said, I was there a couple of weeks ago, and you know, this nun came out, and she asked me if I wanted to go and meditate in the master's room because she thought I looked receptive. And I looked at him, and I said, that is very rare. Anyway, it just, but I, all that to say is to find spirituality in the daily life of our relationships, we have to sort out what's real from what's not, the light and shade, the passing, the transitory, and just stay in the joy of what is. I remember once two of my good friends were, a married couple, were having a heated discussion. And the husband, the wife who's a good friend of mine told me this, and the husband, and they're both yogis, great yogis, the husband looked at her and they were kind of going at it. You always do this, now you always do that. And the husband looked at the wife and said, I'm not caught yet, are you caught yet? Meaning, even though we're arguing, I haven't lost my centeredness. I haven't lost the reality, the core of my being. And this was also the same, a beautiful story with the same couple related to this. They were having another argument at another time. And she told me the story. We were, one day we had gone for a walk, and I said to her, oh, I just happened to mention Swami called from Assisi last night to tell us, discuss something. And she got a little sad, and she said, oh, Swami never calls us. And then she said, no, that's not true. He did one time. My husband and I were having a big argument. We went to sleep angry with each other, and we woke up angry at each other, and then the phone rang, and it was Swami, the one and only time he'd ever called us. And he said, I just want to thank you both for your beautiful spirit. And we just looked at each other. We both just started crying, and that was the end of it. So, you know, God is always there. So finding in our relationships to find that, in our daily life, in what we do, whatever it is, whatever we've chosen, whatever our dharma is, again, to try to look past the shifting sands of change. This person's, you know, this project isn't going well, this project is going very well. This material didn't arrive on time, then we need it for the production, and these people are being competitive and undercutting. All those things, they'll always be there because it's the nature of Maya. But if we can just focus with depth and calmness and impersonalness, and go deep in what we're doing, then it doesn't matter what happens around us. We can accomplish so much more with that sense of, I am in a flow of what's true and real. The world around me is a shifting panorama. Swami was saying, if you're in a house of mirrors, it's very hard to get focused because all you can see are, and this world is a house of mirrors, isn't it? It's just reflections of our own thoughts. And the more we understand that, the more we understand if I control my thoughts, if my thoughts are centered in what's real and true and the joy underlying everything, then the house of mirrors has, it dissolves. And we can see beyond that. And you know, when there's many beautiful books that are being written now about people with near-death experiences, one of the most beautiful, it's a couple of years old now, Proof of Heaven, a remarkable book. But these people who go, leave the body, leave this world of light and shadow, and rest in the astral world for a while, and the presence of the joy and the light. But we can bring this into our daily life, whatever it is we're doing. You know, there's a, some of you were there the other night. We talked a little bit about this charitable work that Ananda is doing in India, the Paramahansa Yogananda Charitable Trust in the city of Vrindavan, or Vrindavan. The more Bengali pronunciation which Master uses is with the B's. He uses that in autobiography, Vrindavan. But the city itself, they use more of the Hindi, which is with the B, Vrindavan. But in the city, there are thousands of widows that have been abandoned, thrown out of their family, on the street. They estimate 7,000 of them, elderly, ill. And so Ananda has gone there, and we have established a charitable work for the widows of Vrindavan and are serving them. Both, we have Kriyaban doctors who are part of our work that are setting up small neighborhood clinics. We have distribution of food. But one of the women, young woman, who's kind of the one of the main part of the staff there, she was born in Vrindavan, but from an early age, and we've met her. She doesn't speak much English. Her name is Shama. She's probably early 20s now. But from an early age, she would just go out, help the widows on the street, just on her own. But she also was a saintly person, truly. Her mother told our representatives there that when she was a little girl, she would just sing to Krishna, and she would go up on the roof of their house, and she would go into ecstasy and just dance. And so her family had to sleep around the edge of the roof so she wouldn't fall off. And they got tired of doing that. So they said, we can't do this night after night. We're not getting any sleep. So they locked her in her room. But all she had to do was chant to Krishna, her mother told us, and touch the door, and the door would open. And she'd go up on the roof and dance to Krishna in ecstasy. And so they gave up. They said, okay, you dance and we'll sleep around the perimeter. But what does she do? Day after day, she's distributing food to the needy in Vrindavan. 3,000 a month are supplied, 1,000 daily with milk and fresh vegetables. But we have some videos of it, and you can see her there just putting milk into the little cups that the widows bring. But it's with the joy that comes from feeling the presence of God. And then whatever you're doing, it really, there's no better or worse as far in God's eyes. Well, I'm a CEO and I'm a street cleaner. It doesn't really matter. And so often, you know, we'll be going back to India end of August, beginning of September. And we so love to be there because you see in the eyes of everyone, from the little ironing walla, the little guy ironing your clothes, to the cab driver, you just see this understanding that this world, it's God's world. It's not that real. I will live my life. And, you know, we were talking with a man recently, a very fine Brahmin man in Chennai, who was a retired CEO of a big business there. And he said, it's sad to see what's happening in India now, because there was a time that people were contented. They knew that life was about service. And it didn't matter if what we did, it wasn't that important. But it's changing now, he said. And everybody wants to be the CEO. Everybody wants to have the top job. He said, everybody can't be the CEO. And so there's restlessness and frustration and all that. And so to do whatever we do with the joy of God, and that's what gives it meaning. That's what gives it power, not the thing in of itself. And as devotees, it's wonderful to be able to live our life that way. And then I want to touch on two more areas of our daily life. One is setting our own priorities. setting our own values in life. Because if we don't really from time to time stop and take account of where we are, gee, I'm X number of years old. Maybe I have X number of years left. What do I want to accomplish in that time? You know, most people never think that way. They just drift along and life is over and they think, well, what was that all about? But if we stop at this point in time and say, just as Jyotish was showing his balancing skills, aligning ourselves with these values of moving away from what's passing, looking at our life, what is eternal, what is real, what do I want to hold on to, and what brings me joy. We were showing the movie Finding Happiness to a group of my extended family, and one of the members there, and at the end, if you recall the beautiful scene when the Juliet, Elizabeth Rome, is asking Swami, well, how can I keep this experience that I've had here? And Swami said, well, live your life in such a way that you live for happiness, you live for joy. And one of my relatives, who's just not at all a devotee, she just came up to me and she was weeping. And she said, and she'd never met Swami, and she said, Swami said we should live our lives to be happy. I have a job that I hate. I don't need to work anymore. I've got enough material things. I'm going to quit that job. And she did. And, you know, to look at your life and say, how can I align it with that joy? Don't compromise. I mean, it's not that life is going to be perfect. That would be a contradiction of what we've been saying. It won't be perfect. But we can make choices. If you're always if you have a neighbor or a relative that calls you every day and just spews out negativity, you don't have to talk to that person. You can make an excuse to get off the phone. You don't have to. So we have choices to look at your life and take tally. What's important and what am I doing to further my ability to feel the eternal joy that is my birthright? And if we can do that, then that's a life well lived. At the end of the chapter, however long it may be, then we can say, I got it. I got outside of the box. I got outside of the envelope. I got outside of the delusion. And I was able to steer my boat in a direction I wanted to go. And that's a great gift. You know, in one of the affirmations for self-healing, it's on willpower. And Swami says, I wish I had a copy, but don't run and get it. But he said there are different kinds of willpower. There's, you know, willpower with effort. There's willpower with the flow of God. But then there's a kind of willpower that is able to put out the energy to change the world around you. And how do you do that? By getting outside of the world of duality. And how do we do that? By longer, deeper, thirsty, guru-given meditation. It's a big, beautiful cycle. But we have to know what we're wanting. You can't get there if you don't know where you're going. And if you know you're going for joy, if you know you're going towards real happiness and looking at what's real in your relationships, in the workplace, in your values, in your meditation, then as we move forward in life, you'll be able to move in that direction. There's many jokes about the natives of the state of Maine, who apparently have a very dry sense of humor. So there was one, a tourist was driving along and he gets lost and he sees a farmer there in his field and he pulls over and he goes, how do I get to such and such a town? And this Maine farmer says, well, you go down the road. Oh, I can't do a Maine accent, but I love Maine accent. Anyway, you go down the road a piece and then you make a right. And then you go towards the hill. No, that won't take you there. And so he gives him three or four different alternate routes. And then he goes, no, that won't take you there. And finally he looks at the guy and he goes, you know, you can't get there from here. And How do we become a Jivan Mukta? We can't get there from the ego. We can't get there from here. We've got to break the bundles of self-definition and say, in joy I live, from joy I came, for joy I live, in sacred joy I melt again. And then it all begins to dissolve, and we realize that daily life, meditation, with people, alone, serving, resting, none of it matters. The Spirit of God, the joy of God, as Swami described it, is like a subterranean river that flows beneath the sands of all the different experiences of our life. So we hope these thoughts are helpful to you, and thank you for being with us this morning.